Good morning. I can't see any of you over there, so I'm going to move out here today. There's a post in my way. And if any of you were hoping that Byron Nystrom was going to give this service today, I don't know if you're going to be pleasantly surprised or a little disappointed, but it's me. And the funniest thing is I proofread this this leaflet last week, and I missed that. Anyway, in mid-March 2025, the World Happiness Report was released. Since 2012, a United Nations-backed project has issued a report ranking how the inhabitants of countries throughout the world perceive their own happiness. Countries are ranked based on how a sample of 1,000 people in each country answered this question. Please imagine a ladder with steps numbered from 0 at the bottom to 10 at the top. The top rung of the ladder represents the best possible life for you, and the bottom of the ladder represents the worst possible life for you. On which step of the ladder would you say you personally feel you stand at this time? Interesting. Notice that the word happiness does not appear in any part of that question. It's assumed that a person who is living their best possible life will be at the top of the ladder, hence the happiest, and that a person who is living their worst possible life won't even get off the ground. And I think that maybe this poll of 1,000 people from 100 countries might be a better measure of how content they are, how much meaning they find in their lives, and maybe that is actually a better measure of happiness than any that I can think of. We love rankings, don't we? I mean, at least if we're at the top or near the top of whatever the ranking might be. How did the U.S. do in this ranking of national happiness? Out of 100 countries, we came in at number 24. Scandinavian countries reliably come in near the top, and this year, Finlanders self-identified as the happiest, most content population in the world. There is a hilarious and very informative op-ed piece in the New York Times published on Friday. It was written by Molly Young, an American journalist who went to Helsinki in February to try to understand why the Finns think of themselves as being so happy. And let's face it, if you think that you're happy, you're just happy, right? But anyway, it's funny because she goes in February and it's really dark and dreary in Finland at that time, and the coffee cups are very small. But they do have saunas, and it seems to be sort of their national pastime to take saunas together. And in her essay, she speculates on the reasons that Finland and other Scandinavian countries that always lead the list of happiest countries in the world are, in fact, the happiest. She speculates that the social safety nets are strong and resilient. Family and community are strongly held values, and there's a lower level of anxiety that should something go wrong in a person's life, they will be okay. And since the World Happiness Report came out, there have been countless commentaries, essays, think pieces, if you will, written on why we rank so low. Below Canada, which is at number 18, and below Mexico, which is at number 10. Now, I don't put a whole lot of stock in rankings, and I'm not all that concerned that Lithuania, Slovenia, and the United Arab Emirates all rank higher in happiness than we do. I'm not any more concerned about that than how much attention I pay to the best of Jackson Hole ratings, you know, who's the best personal trainer or which is the best radio station. Of course, I've got my own favorites, but I'm not about to change trainers or where I listen to the radio based on a popularity contest. Of course, I do encourage you all, when the time is right, to vote for Browsenby as the best thrift store in the valley, because I know how important that is to Lonnie. Anyway, it's fascinating to read all the analysis around our ranking in the happiness quotient and to think about why we, arguably the freest and most prosperous country in the world, don't see ourselves as the happiest and most content country in the world. And there are many ways of interpreting why this is. I've got my own thoughts on that. You probably have your own thoughts on that too. But that's not what this sermon is about. Going back to the actual question asked in the survey, it's about, are you living the best possible life for you? It's also about what Jesus told Peter on the beach that morning as they sat around a campfire and ate a breakfast of fish and bread together. And this little vignette from John's Gospel takes place on the shores of the Sea of Tiberias, which we are probably more familiar with the name, the Sea of Galilee. The disciples have made their way back home. They've traveled to Jerusalem with Jesus, where he had been crucified and resurrected and shown himself to them in the upper room after he had risen. To say that they had been through a lot is a gross understatement. Now they were back where it all began, where it all started for them, where they had first been called to follow Jesus. And I wonder what they were feeling that day. I think maybe they were hoping for a return to normalcy, back to their original normal lives. After all, Peter, the first to spoke up, says the most normal thing, the most Peter-like thing, if you will. He says, I'm going fishing. Beautiful, right? I'm going to go out in the boat and catch some fish. The other six who were there with him said, we're in. Let's go. Every fisher person here in this room this morning can relate to this. When in doubt, go fishing. And you can probably also relate to the next line, somewhat sadly. That night, they caught nothing. Then things turn kind of crazy, a little surreal. It's just starting to get light out. That magical, mystical time of the day when things begin gradually to come into view, when the darkness of night fades and the light brings things into view. And there he was, Jesus standing on the beach. And though they were 100 yards out, somehow they could hear his voice. I doubt he was yelling. He might have been whispering, but his voice was clear. Children, you have no fish, have you? And they answered, no. And he said again, not shouting, try the other side. And that's what they did. But why was the right side of the boat the right side? Who knows? But suddenly their nets were full. So full that they couldn't even haul all the fish into the boat. And then the actual craziest thing happens. Peter puts on some clothes and jumps into the water. I'm not going to even try to explain that. I'm just going to leave that right there. But anyway, after this surreal, somewhat comical fishing scene, call it a fish story if you like, they all made it back to shore with 153 fish in their untorn net. And Jesus was waiting for them there. He had made the 85-mile trip from Jerusalem to Galilee too, and had built a charcoal campfire on the beach and had started cooking breakfast. "Bring me some of those fish you have caught," he said, and then he started serving them breakfast. Or was it communion? The bread and the fish of heaven. Part of me wishes that we did that here at St. John's. I doubt it, but who knows? Maybe someday we'll surprise you with a little piece of smoked salmon. Don't worry, it's probably not going to happen. Is it, Jimmy? But wouldn't that be cool, just as a reminder of how surprising and how wild the story of Jesus' lavish love for his followers is.
Can't we find another way to do it? What about candy?
Breakfast was over. Everybody was full. The charcoal campfire was smoldering. And I have to think, if Jesus' friends had hoped that by going home that things would return back to normal, well, they probably abandoned that hope, sitting next to that fire, eating breakfast with Jesus. And they also must have wondered what to hope for next. They remembered everything that had happened in Jerusalem, and Peter must have remembered with shame how he behaved the night that Jesus was captured in the courtyard of the high priest, warming himself by another charcoal fire. He had denied knowing Jesus 3 times. How could Peter possibly forgive himself for that? How could Jesus? And here is where Jesus asks the question that I believe at some point in our lives we all want to ask and are afraid to ask for fear of sounding needy. But Jesus, remember, is fearless and honest. And so he asks Peter, "Do you love me?" Not, "Are you sorry for the way you behaved? Do you regret all the stupid, hurtful things you have done? How you betrayed me?" And this must have broken Peter's heart, broken it open. "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." Jesus says simply, "Feed my sheep." Again, "Do you love me?" Again, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Tend my sheep." Again, "Do you love me?" And this time I hear Peter's voice crack as he says, "Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you." And Jesus says, "Feed my sheep." And this is not Jesus imposing some sort of penitence upon Peter for betraying him, a quid pro quo. "You betrayed me 3 times. Now go feed my sheep and tend to my flock, the people that I loved so much that I was unwilling to betray them to save my own life." Jesus is telling Peter that full, vibrant, dare I say happy and contented life, abundant life, is realized in caring for, feeding, and tending to the needs of others. Forgiveness and grace are givens. Peter and we don't have to earn our way into heaven. In fact, we can't. And we probably can't earn our way into lives that are meaningful and content. To the American mind and to some versions of Christian thought, this sounds almost offensive. If I can't earn my way into happiness, it must not be true happiness after all. If getting my own needs met won't bring me happiness, what will? Jesus is telling Peter here, and he's telling us 3 times so that we don't miss the point. The top of the ladder of happiness that represents the best possible life for you is in taking your eyes off of the supposed prize of personal fulfillment and to turn your gaze to the needs of the others who inhabit the world with you. Your neighbors are hurting and hungry. If you're blessed with resources, feed them. If your only resource is a loving heart, that's enough. That's more than enough. Love them, no matter what. The earth, God's creation, is crying out, injured by years of industrial degradation. Walk softly. Find ways to work for ways that heal the damage we have done and move us creatively into a more sustainable future. Our political landscape today is divided by a deep chasm. Find ways to communicate with people you don't agree with, even those whose views you don't understand or find dangerous. Stand up for what you believe in your heart is right, but take a little gentler grasp on whatever ideology you hold. Jesus' most challenging commandment is to find a way to love your enemy. At least that's Jesus' most challenging commandment to me. Let's remember Jesus' loving words to fallible Peter and to our fallible selves. Tend my sheep. And brothers and sisters, you are all doing so much good work individually and through this church and through other organizations in Jackson Hole and way, way beyond. And so I may be preaching to the choir here. You're tending many flocks and feeding many sheep. And perhaps you're already standing on the top rung of that ladder of happiness. I sincerely hope that you are. But what if we look around us at those who are still suffering in mind, body, or spirit? What are we to do? We each have our own lives to live, and sometimes it can take all the energy we can muster just to get through the day. Take care of yourselves. Find rest and peace wherever you can. And something that occurred to me only after I had preached this sermon at 8 o'clock this morning is we're not only shepherds, we are also sheep. So there's nothing wrong with being vulnerable enough to ask for help when you need it. Being a sheep is equally as important as being a shepherd. We all find ourselves in one role or another at many times in our lives. What a beautiful flock of sheep. And remember, Jesus told Peter three times, lest he forget, to love and care for one another. It's a message that we can all return to when we lose our way. Amen.